I should die now, it will be with the certainty that my faith has been righteous. And if through death larger mysteries are revealed, I will have already learned the answer to the question that has driven me here. That there is intelligent life in the universe other than our own. That they are here among us. And that they have begun to colonize.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, as always, although not quite always, because last week Carl Sweeney was the host, but I'm back. I've recovered from my illness, and I'm covering the first of a two-part episode, which is one of the most exciting and probably seminal X-Files ever. This time we're talking Season 2's Colony. And I am joined once again, because he can't keep away, by Mr. Darren Mooney for this episode. Well, for these two episodes, actually.
Hello, how are things?
All good. Thank you for coming back on to...
My pleasure.
Yeah, to talk some Colony and Endgame, which is obviously the second part of the of this two-parter in the middle. Well, that's three quarters into Season 2. That is a real sort of turning point for the show. But we'll get into all of this. Before that, how have you been? How are things going on your side?
I think so. Things are grand. I had a bit of good news there during the week when I found out that my fiction novel has been longlisted for the Mercier Prize, Mercier Press Fiction Prize, which is very, very cool. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that will go well.
That's awesome. Tell us a little bit about it.
It's a novel that I sat down and decided to write. You know the way everybody figures they want to write a novel at some point. And I sort of figured that if I didn't do it now, I mean, I'm 30 years old. My life is almost over at this stage, Tony. You know, it's more behind me than ahead of me.
I'm not going to tell you my age.
It's all over. It's all downhill from here, man.
Oh, I know.
Thanks for the reassurance. I really appreciate it.
Oh,
that.
I mean, don't be silly, Darren. It's the start of your life. You're in the prime of your life. Yeah. Is that what you wanted to hear?
30 is the new 28. Yeah, 30 is the new 28. But so I sat down. I figured I'd write it because I had been thinking about it for a while, because I think everybody's sort of been thinking about writing something at some stage. And I sort of wrote it. It got written somehow through some miracle, and I basically sent it around, submitted to various places and stuff, and I found out during the week that it made the long list of this Irish press company, this Irish publishing house, which is Mercier Press, who do sort of Irish interest fiction. It made their long list, and the short list will be coming out in May, so hopefully with a bit of fingers crossed, I might make it from that step to a step up. But it was pretty nice. It was a pretty pleasant surprise, to be honest.
Yeah. That's terrific. Is it available? Can people buy it? What's it called?
It's The Thirsty Earth. It's not actually available yet. The competition is, unfortunately, to see whether or not it will be published. But it's for unpublished fiction, which is pretty cool. It's an Irish Civil War Western. And, you know, if there are any literary agents listening, I mean, hey, drop me a line. I'll have my people talk to your people. We'll figure it out.
Is the lead character's name Sullivan Biddle? That's the big question.
Unfortunately not. No. They said, was it that wild observation that everybody's first novel either themselves as God or Lucifer? So, you know, I think that the main character's name, unsurprisingly, is Maren Dooney. And it's a completely original creation. Bears no resemblance to anybody that anybody's aware of. And it's basically about his love and affection of the X-Files, including commentary on podcasts. But I mean, I had to draw from sort of, you know, I had to do research, extensive research on it.
Well, they say write what you know, don't they?
They do. It didn't do me much good, though, unfortunately. But no, it's basically an American style Western set in Ireland in the 1920s. Basically, a bunch of people ride to the West, and then they ride to the East, and everything works out perfectly in the end.
Wonderful.
I may need to work on my pitch.
Which sounds a lot better than the novel I'm writing, which is about a depressed 35-year-old man living in Birmingham, realising that his 30s are the beginning of the end, really. You know, it's a very mournful novel.
Solemn Reflection.
That's the title. How did you know? I'm not depressed at all. How could I be depressed when I'm about to talk about these two episodes? So, let's get on with it. Let's discuss Colony. Colony is the 16th episode of the second season of The X-Files. It first aired on February the 10th, 1995. It was written by, well, the story was by David Duchovny and Chris Carter. David Duchovny's first ever story credit for The X-Files behind the scenes. And the teleplay was by Chris Carter on his own. The episode was directed by Nick Mark. And after three identical men are killed and their obituaries are emailed to Mulder, a mysterious agent appears and tells Mulder and Scully about a long-standing conspiracy involving potential cloned men. And there may be a UFO involved as well.
What are you working on?
I found these in my email this morning. Three obituaries.
Sent by whom?
Nobody I know, but obviously somebody that knows me.
Why?
The deceased are Dr. Landon Prince of Scranton, Pennsylvania, Dr. Dale Gayhart of New York City, and Dr. Harvey Buchanan of Teaneck, New Jersey. All worked in abortion clinics. They died in separate arson fires.
Sounds like the work of militant right-to-lifers.
Sounds like it.
Why would somebody send them to you?
It's taken me all morning to figure that out.
What'd you find?
This is the latest victim, Dr. Landon Prince. And these are the other two victims, Drs. Gayhart and Buchanan.
Triplets?
Nope. I can't find any blood connection between them. In fact, I can't find any records on them at all. It's as if before they died, they never existed.
I shouldn't be worried about spoilers, should I really, Darren, at this stage?
I think people know what they're getting at this point. And I think it's a good pitch, though. I mean, it's a bunch of three identical men. Their obituaries mailed to Mulder. I think everything after that you can kind of sort of run with. Although I do like the intro. The intro to the episode is kind of one of those great drop you sort of in media res sort of moments. But we'll probably talk about that a bit more in depth in a moment. But I think just in general, yeah, it's an awesome episode. It's a great episode.
Well, you've headed off my question there, which is, what would you give Colony out of 10, Darren?
I feel like after I've bigged it up, this is going to be a bit of an anticlimax, because I'm going to go with a 7.
Oh, that's lower than I thought you'd give it, actually.
It is, and I suspect that next week you will receive the grade, perhaps, that you were expecting. But I think that Colony and Endgame together are a phenomenal piece of television. I think you're right when you sort of said that this is one of the archetypal X-Files episodes. Like, this is, like, we'll probably talk about the conspiracy and sort of the mythology and all this sort of stuff in a bit more depth later on. But in terms of, like, laying down what you expect from an X-Files episode and what you expect from mythology two-parter. Because obviously they'd done, like, Dwayne Barry and Ascension earlier in the season. But this is much more like what you get from here until, say, was it Two Fathers, One Son, where you have this sort of, like, it's almost a laundry list of all the great X-Files sort of, I don't want to call them cliches because that's very diminishing, but all those great X-Files elements, say, for example, like you've got the Chris Carter purple prose, which is layered on incredibly thick, but it's still so good. You've got like the Frankenstein references, which again are sort of like a Chris Carter sort of calling card that he comes back to. You've got like the alien bounty hunter, who is like one of the great X-Files supporting characters, despite the fact I think you're lucky if he has like 20 lines of dialogue over the entire 9-year run of the series. And then you've got this, like, this sense of scale, which is what I really love about the two-parter, and which is why I probably graded the first part a bit lower than I will grade the second part, if we're being entirely honest, cards on the table, which is like these episodes really open up the idea of the X-Files as like blockbuster movie style television. Like, narratively they've always been sort of like a film every week, where it's been like it's got its supporting cast, it's got a high concept, it's got a plot, it's got all these elements that you would expect from like a film each and every week. But in terms of like blockbuster execution style stuff, like, I don't want to jump too far ahead and get into the discussion of Endgame, but like visually a lot of what we expect from the mythology episodes is sort of laid out here in terms of like the lighting, the mood, and even just the sense of like the production team going for that little extra oomph. Like, you know, the opening scene of Colony begins with like Mulder being dragged by helicopter from the Arctic Circle, which gives you a sense of scale that, I mean, even say Dwayne Barry in Ascension didn't quite have, which is like Mulder's literally gone to the ends of the earth in this, and he's been pulled back from that. And it's just, it's a mile a minute. It's just, it's like, it's what you expect from the X-Files mythology in a way that I don't think necessarily like Dwayne Barry in Ascension had quite figured out yet. When you go on from here, like Nysi and 731, Piper Maru, Apocrya, Tunguska, Terma, they all sort of adhere to like the I don't want to say the blueprint, but like the beats that are laid out and sort of set here are sort of like are hit again and again and again. And it's like you can almost see like this is where Carter decides this is not necessarily what he wants the mythology to be, but how he wants to tell these stories.
They're like the blockbuster stories, aren't they, these? I mean, this is the thing with Good Colony and Endgame. It's the first. And I think you may have said this earlier in the season, actually, in one of the episodes you were on, possibly the Dwayne Barry Ascension two-parter, which was the last, obviously, as well as One Breath, was the last real big dose of mythology that the show had. And it's, you know, that's seen as the beginning of the mythology traditionally. But in many respects, I think you could say that about Colony and Endgame, like you've been saying, because it does introduce, like you said, that sense of scale, that sense of genuine alien, you know, figures involved. I mean, before we've had EBEs, we've had, you know, little green men, you know, appearing, you know, we've had like
shadows and silhouettes and off screen and all this sort of stuff.
But this is the first time we get a guy who is interacting with the characters who is so alien.
You know, he changes his face on screen.
He's not even an alien that we've come to expect from mythology and lore. This guy might as well be in Deep Space Nine. You know, it's that same thing. He's truly from another planet, and that is the first time they've ever done that in this way.
Yeah, and I think that's remarkable, because you get the sense when you watch the kind of... I don't know if I talked about this when we were talking about Dwayne Barry in Ascension, but in terms of, like, with the first two seasons of The X-Files, it felt like the production team were sort of figuring out what they were doing and where they were doing it. So you had, like, I think, like, when you talk about the mythology and the mythology becoming sort of fully formed in, say, the second and third seasons as opposed to the first, what you see in the first is you see all these little ideas that sort of come through. And I think that, like, you could say in Colony and Endgame, like, a lot of the ideas that become the mythology in Colony and Endgame, so, for example, like, the idea of colonization or the idea of cloning, or even the suggestion that sort of something's buried underneath the surface of the planet. Those were all laid out, not in the mythology episodes of season one, but in stuff like, say, for example, the Gender Bender or even Eve, and sort of like these standalone episodes that are not generally considered the mythology, but are thematically like Carter's like, okay, yoink, grab those. What we're going to do is instead of doing like single episodes about cloning and copies and twins, what we're going to do is we're going to weave this into the core fabric of the show. And I think that, like, Colony and Endgame are notable for sort of, like, they're almost like a sort of a molding or, like, a sculpting or shaping of, like, stuff that's been happening to this point. But in a way that's like, okay, well, we're gonna outline what we want to do with it. And when we come back in the third season, well, we'll just pick up where we left off and we will marathon, we will run. And I think that's remarkable looking at it. And it could easily have been, like, remember the first season when they did the aliens in the first season. So what you talk about, like EBE, for example, you talk about Fallen Angel. Like, the show was always very cautious about what it showed and what it didn't show. But, like, as you said there, like, Colony has a dude who can change his face right in front of you. And people who, like, I know that you had green blood in, say, the Erlenmeyer flask, and you had those sort of crates in the Erlenmeyer flask. But, like, it's really explicit here. There's no getting around it. To the point that when you get that cover story that you alluded to, which is, like, these Cold War agents called the Gregors, who are actually twins who've been cloned, you know, in the first season, you go, okay, actually, that's a pretty plausible explanation. When you're hearing it at this point, you're like, oh, that is such a boring explanation, if that's what this turns out to be.
It's that kind of not quite unbelievable, but also, you know, completely out there kind of explanation, which is one of the things that I think Carter plays with in this episode. I would give this a bit more than you. I think I'd give this about an 8.5, I would say.
All right.
I've long debated whether or not I like this more than Endgame. And I think I still like Endgame just a little bit more. You know, because the thing is, Kang and Endgame are unusual in the sense that quite a lot of X-Files two-parters, the second half doesn't quite live up to the first in a fair few of them. The first half often has really good setup, and the second half doesn't quite do it.
Yeah, the second half runs really fast so that you don't notice they're not answering any of the questions they ask.
Yeah, it just becomes a big chase or something like that. Whereas, and you know, this one does have those elements. It's a lot more action-packed, but, you know, in Endgame. But I think Colony really well establishes a mystery and introduces the alien bounty hunter in a really unnerving, straightforward way. You know, it doesn't mess about. It's straight into the story. There's lots and lots going on. There's underlayers of drama. There's a lot here, and I think as a setup, it's a very different episode, oddly enough, from Endgame. You know, they're two very, it might be a two-parter, but they're very different in many ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's much more sort of, much more, as you said, constrained and stuff, and sort of like boxed in. Even if you open with Mulder coming down from the Arctic Circle, like, you don't really get any of that huge scale until you get to the second part. Like, I would argue, and I feel kind of bad now that you gave it like an 8.5. I didn't know we were allowed to give 0.5, so I'll probably go up to 7.5.
Yeah, we can give 0.5s. There's no rule.
We'll go to a 7.5. No, exactly 7.666 recurring. But I do think that one of the reasons that I don't like Colony as much as I like Endgame, and I feel kind of bad saying this, is that the direction in Colony by Nick Mark is not anywhere near as good as the direction in Endgame by Rob Bowman.
I agree with that, yeah.
Like, I think that Colony looks very good as a piece of 90s television, but I think that, like, and it's interesting because I assume are you watching this in HD, in high definition?
Yes, yeah,
in
my Blu-ray.
This is the first time I'd watched Carter in high definition. And you can really see that, like, Colony looks good. Endgame you could have stuck on a big screen in, like, the early 90s and it would have impressed. I think the Colony has moments. There's a great moment where one of the Gregors throws himself out the window, and then he picks himself up off the ground, and it's meant to look really creepy because it's like his head is twisted the wrong way around. But because of the way it's shot in high definition, which, to be fair, they couldn't have planned at the time, you can see the actor is just wearing the coat backwards, for example. Or there's another moment where Scully's like, I think I'm being followed, on the phone to Mulder, and she looks out the window. And on a standard definition television screen, which is what this was made for, to be clear, but the alien bounty hunter is sitting there about 20 feet away. Now, in high definition, it's kind of like when Scully says, I think I'm being followed, and Brian Thompson is, like, sitting close enough that he could, like, throw the wrapping of his donut and wrap the window. It's not quite as impressive. And I think that, like, Endgame looks like a feature film, and Colony looks like a good episode of television. And I do think that's probably why I'm more biased or more partial to Endgame.
I can't disagree with that. I can't. I mean, funnily enough, it's strange. A little bit like with Paul Brown involved in Ascension. Nick Mark only was involved in this one episode of The X-Files. You know, he only directed one. He was a jobbing director, and he's done. You look at his IMDb, he did, like, everything. He did Northern Exposure. He did American Gothic. He did Charmed.
He's still doing Creek. Stuff. Still doing Veronica. Veronica Mars, isn't he? Or he did Veronica Mars relatively recently. Like, so it's not a knock on him that he's not as good as Rob Bowman, the guy who, like, Carter chose to direct the feature film version of the show.
But he's not one of the, you know, stock, you know, we talked in the last few weeks about Rob Bowman and Kim Manners, who take episodes that are good, but they're not, like, outstandingly good, but they make them better by the way they make them look and feel.
Yeah,
and I think you're absolutely right. And Colony does suffer a little bit from somebody who's coming to do a job, as opposed to the actual directors who'd got under the skin of the show, like Chris Carter did, and understood it instinctually. And I think people like Rob Bowman and you know, co do, and did very early on. So Colony's not badly directed by any stretch of the word, but it is lacking something, and it is a little bit more straightforward. But I think it has a lot of really interesting things in it, and. I've always been hugely fond of it, certainly as a first parter. On IMDb, it has an aggregate rating of 9.0 from 2,500.
That put me in my place.
2,537 votes. Now, that puts it in the very top of the season. It's only beaten by Anasazi, actually, And oh. Endgame has the, to spoil it for next time, Endgame has the same thing, 9.0. Only Anasazi tops it this season, so it's in the top three of the episodes of the season. Now, that's debatable. I mean, I'd put these in the top, probably in the top five or six. Certainly Endgame would be in the top five. Whether Colony is, I would certainly say it's in the top 10, but whether it's in the top five, I don't know. But it has a good, you know, general aggregate rating. I think a lot of people agree, as we both do, this is a very, very impressive episode.
Yeah, I feel like I've been overly negative, or it sounds like I'm being overly negative. Oh my God, this is only a really good episode of television, Tony. I mean, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, the bar is just so high now, though, with the X-Files. We've got to that point already that, you know, nothing, you know, will be accepted but greatness. So let's unpick this even more and get talking about Colony in depth. So you mentioned earlier about the teaser and how the episode starts. It's got what is probably the second, like, Mulder monologue, isn't it? I mean, Little Green Men, which obviously you run, did it first. But this is better. I mean, this is a better one, I think. I think this one really stands out. I mean, it's more like a mission statement, this is. It's more like reaffirming who Mulder is and what he's doing in, like, 2 minutes. Or less.
Really is. It's one of those great, and we talk about like Chris Carter dialogue and Chris Carter sort of the way that he writes and stuff. And I think that we, in some respects, like Carter comes in for an undue amount of criticism because he occasionally doesn't, say, rein himself in as much as he should. But when he's on fire, he's really, really, really good. And I think that like Colony is perhaps the first moment that he really kind of cuts loose with this wonderful monologue. And the thing about the monologue, which is so good, is that it's, in the process of the 2 minutes that you hear it, it drops a surprising number of bombshells, basically. Stuff that, like, there are points when I was watching the monologue again, I was kind of going, okay, well, they're going to cut to the opening credits here. And it's like, nope, no, they're not. So he's like, I discovered that alien life actually existed. And you're like, okay, that's the perfect point to cut the teaser and sort of have the credits roll. It's like, nope, not done yet. Okay, they're here. And they're going to colonize. And okay, well, there's the moment you cut the trailer. You've done. You've gone even bigger. And it's like, nope. Okay, we're keep going. And it's basically it's so one of the things about like Carter as the X-Files mythology goes is there's a lot of I think we talked about this before where there's a lot of criticism of the mythology for not making sense, and it doesn't necessarily make sense with all the little details. But you get a sense that he had these ideas of where he was going, like thematically, and like you can see that like. In Colony, obviously with the title Colony, like he's talking about colonization already. And it doesn't become explicit until like the end of the third season that this is okay, this is what the mythology is actually about. But he says it right there in the opening lines of the episode. Oh, by the way, those aliens are here to colonize. Like it's a wonderful sort of statement of purpose in a sense that like even if he didn't know the little turns that the story was going to take or the narrative hooks, he sort of knew what it was going to be about, if that makes sense.
It does have that, you know, by using that very word, it shows, like you say, it's in his mindset. I think what he wanted to get across with this and with the idea of these cloned guys is the sense of how scary it is at the idea that there might be aliens living among us, you know, and that's despite the whole mythology element that he obviously explores later on and does a lot more with, the very idea that there might be extraterrestrials living among us who look like us. Is a scary, it's almost like a Body Snatchers idea in a way, even though this isn't a Body Snatchers episode. It's that idea of, you know, the pod people who look like us, but they're not us. And it's that whole sort of, you know, Red Scare fear as well. You know, it's that whole, and it's been in American mythology for 50-odd years, this idea of people among us who aren't us. And it really comes out in this episode.
Well, not even people who are among us who aren't us, but people among us who are all the same. Like this fear of homogeny that sort of bubbles through the X-Files. And like, I sort of talked about it a moment earlier, where it's like, because like you could argue the connection with Colony and Endgame isn't necessarily to say Ascension or Dwayne Barry. It's more back to episodes like, say, Eve, which had a similar thing about like twins and clones and sort of people who looked exactly alike and how creepy that was. And sort of this, I think Eve even tied it to the Cold War in the same way that I think Colony does as well, where it sort of says, well, look, imagine that there are these people who are all identical who are living among us. which is, I think, as you said, it's a core American fear. It's a fear of, say, communism and sort of, and it's interesting that that's where the agent sort of, or the alien bounty hunter posing as, is it Agent Chapel, sort of takes the idea. And it's sort of, it is this sort of core idea, but it also, it, like, it plays out across. Because, I mean, even in Colony and Endgame, right, which, I mean, might talk about it when we get to sort of the Gregors and stuff, which doesn't necessarily fit, like, if you try to retrofit Colony and Endgame into the mythology in terms of, well, A happens and then B happens, and that because of that C happens, it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. But in terms of, like, this is what the mythology is about, which is it's about, like, clones and it's about hybrids. And, like, the Gregors are, like, constantly trying to hybridize themselves with human tissue, which, you know, a bit of a spoiler warning for the later mythology, becomes, like, a big concern for sort of, for Carter and for everybody else. Like, you can see, like, the brushstrokes, if that makes sense, I think, rather than the finer detail here.
No? Absolutely, yeah. It's him playing with ideas. As he's been doing for the last, like, season and a half, he's playing with ideas. Yeah. He's formulating them. He's putting them out there. And, like you say, you can't retrofit everything in the X-Files mythology to make complete sense. You know, I've had the same thing and the same discussion about Lost recently, having done a Lost rewatch. You know, they're very different mythologies, but they're similar in the sense of writers playing with ideas, throwing things out there, and having thematically an understanding of where they're going, but then there are little things that don't tie up if you try and tie them together. But it doesn't affect the thematic ideas and the power of the mythology that takes you forward. And the X-Files is a pioneering example of that. One thing that struck me, apart from the in media res thing, which is you mentioned earlier, which is, if people don't know, it's a Latin term, and it's effectively, I mean, you could probably describe this in a much better way, Darren, but it's effectively the idea of starting a story either at the end or in the middle, and not actually starting at the beginning, going out of linear sequence.
Well, it is. I mean, it's something that can be used very, very, very poorly on television. I mean, you could argue that there's even a great example in the X-Files canon of an episode that uses in media res really, really terribly, Unrequited in the fourth season, which seems to begin in the middle for the pure purposes of having a really good sort of teaser. But I think that, like, in media res works very well for a show like the X-Files, because you could argue the entire show itself is in media res in terms of, like, it's dealing with the consequences of stuff that happened, like, generations ago. And, like, it's no coincidence that Colony introduces, like, Mulder's father, for example, who goes on to become a key mythological figure. This idea that, like, Mulder and Scully are not necessarily discovering something new or interesting or sort of something that's only just come into being, but that they're more digging up the past and sort of exhuming sort of all these compromises that were made. And, like, the reason that things are the way they are involves going back and sort of excavating. And I think that, like, in media res can be a very convenient, a very contrived way of, like, opening with a bang. And I think Colony does, because it opens with pretty much Mulder dying in the after being dragged down from the Arctic. But I do think that it works very well because it lends a sense of scale. And I think, like, it actually, I'm trying to think, is this the first time the Carter basically goes, ooh, Frankenstein, and goes, okay, we're doing this, we're committing to me basically playing with Frankenstein, because Frankenstein's one of his favorite novels, and he comes back to it again and again and again. I mean, the postmodern Prometheus in season 5 is the best example. But, like, Colony and Endgame are, like, they don't have a Frankenstein's monster in it, but they borrow the framing device of Frankenstein almost the letter, which is a man chases a monster across the Arctic and comes across an abandoned and broken ship in which he finds a survivor and which he has a conversation, and then everything is laid out backwards. So you have this sort of this explanation of how the characters came to be where they are by sort of reference this. And, like, I think that you could argue, and this may be me pushing it a bit far here, but, like, Carter, like, and this is something where when I say this, like, shippers are going to throw stuff at the computer, and I apologize in advance when I say that Carter is a romantic writer, because I don't mean Carter is a writer who's good at writing romance, because he's not.
He's not.
I think he's romantic in the historical sense, in the sense of, like, he has this sort of, like, this almost sort of 18th century sort of feeling to it. Like, you get the sense that, you talked about the monologue that Mulder gives at the start of the episode. Like, Chris Carter monologues feel like they could be put in the middle of books as sort of, like, extensive letters from one character to another. in which they sort of lay their soul bare in a way that people don't really do anymore because of emails. And like Mulder's big sort of monologue at the start of Colony, which is like, you know, I have lived with a fragile face built on the ether of vague memories, which is not the way that people talk anymore, arguably, unfortunately. But it is something that feels like it's sort of taken from like an 18th century novel, which I actually like about Carter's style. Like, I like that he doesn't... Like, he wants to write the way that he wants to write, and he clearly has, like, a genre and a style that he appreciates, and he sort of, he goes full tilt into it. I think he goes too full tilt into it at points, but I think that, like, Colony, which is like, okay, we're opening with Frankenstein, and we're basically going to have Mulder read what could just as easily be a letter from, like, Dracula, then we'll go with it. I think that works really well about the teaser.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it does. It's not like Redux, where it's basically just monologues for 45 minutes. It's not that bad.
Redux is like a screensaver over an 18th century novel.
Yeah, it really is. And
corridors, lots of corridors.
Lots of corridors, lots of monologues, lots of footage and explanations. Although I do like Redux, I must say, but that's not the point. It is
Redux 2.
Redux 2 is better. It is an interesting opening. And the other, what I was going to say in tandem with this is the visuals, to me, are very different from everything else Nick Mark did in this episode. My suspicion is that they filmed the opening with this idea of you know, almost UFO lights giving way to like an ambulance light and things like that. I suspect that's Rob Bowman. I suspect that was filmed at the same time as Endgame, and that was brought forward because it fits a lot more in terms of the tone and the style of that episode than it does Colony in many respects. And given that the in media res here is from the end of Endgame, which is unusual in itself, that it actually doesn't like start at the middle of this episode. It starts at the end of the entire story. So it could be. I don't know for sure if that's the case, but it struck me that it might be.
I definitely get that feeling. And I mean, I think you can compare that with, say, like the way the teaser is shot with, say, the way that the footage of the UFO visiting the ship is shot, which would be like a, like, you could argue that, like, Nick Mark, for the rest of the episode, he's shooting a generic sort of urban thriller X-file, and so he's more laid down, he's more refined, but I think that when, or more restrained, but when you get to, say, like, the bit where the ship sees the UFO, like, immediately after the teaser, it's also very sort of generic. I don't want to say pedestrian, but it's very generic and very conventional, whereas the teaser to Colony is, like, it's, you said, you have the light that becomes a helicopter, and it's just, it's like, go, 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 go. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case.
Speaking of, once we're at the teaser, speaking of the UFO crash, why did it need to crash? Why didn't he just land the ship and get out and walk?
This is something I've actually thought about this myself, because again, you would imagine it would be really easy to get out and walk, but I kind of, when I was watching the X-Files through beginning to end last time, what I noticed is, and I'm not sure if this is, like, if it's a conscious choice on the part of Carter, if it's just because of the laws of dramatic sort of license that, you know, it's never interesting to have a spaceship land.
Oh, yeah.
Or whether or not it's just sort of, like, something that happened by coincidence. But, like, the UFOs on the X-Files don't ever seem to land. They always seem to either, like, hover, like they do in, say, Within or Without, where they hover above the surface of the ground, or they actually crash to Earth, as they do here and in, say, The Red and the Black. And I sort of wonder if, like, I think that Carter, like, we talked about Carter being influenced by Frankenstein. My pet theory is, and I think it's something that comes out more in, say, The Red and the Black, which I would argue is, The Red and the Black is pretty much a remake of this, just to integrate it into the existing mythology. But there's this idea of, like, angels falling to Earth and, like, burning up and sort of crashing on the mortal plane. And I wonder if that's... because it's obviously UFOs being fallen angels as sort of, like, Cold War code in the first season episode. But I wonder if that's sort of what he's evoking here, which is, like, fiery, the angels fell, where they sort of, like, they come into contact with the sky and they sort of fall, like, they're burning from heaven, you know? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much.
Maybe not, though, because given how he, you know, much later in the series, conflates God and aliens in a big way, and he makes that a big part of the mythology, it's entirely possible that he's thinking about these things. You know, he very much wants to tie in extraterrestrial conspiracy with religious, well, not just overtones, but actual religious text and mythology. That's something that he does all, in many ways, even though it's much more explicit once you get into things like biogenesis and everything, it's there all the way through, even with the Navajo and, you know, like you say, you know, code names like Fallen Angel. I think he's got that idea always running through it. So, you know, you may be onto something there, and it's an explanation at least as to why he has to crash.
Why couldn't he just park it in the middle of, like, the desert or something? Yeah.
Well, yeah, it would have been much
just
easier.
Sort of, like, park it in the middle.
Yeah. He's just
going to
walk
out, get a bus.
Yeah, he's going to get a bus to go and kill the first doctor in the clinic, which is a really great. I mean, there's so many good things about this. You know, firstly, like Mark Snow's music and listening to the, and we'll talk more about this next week, but listening to Frank Spotnick's commentary for Endgame, he mentions how Mark Snow's music in these two episodes is particularly good. And even for Mark Snow, who's pretty much brilliant.
Yeah, there's a scene in Colony where, like, they're chasing the Gregor through the streets, and it's just this wonderfully oppressive, heavy synth beat.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's amazing. It adds so much.
It does. There's oppressive is a really good description of it, I think. There's this constant sort of, you know, sort of going all the way through it with dong, 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 dong. Yeah. It is a little bit Terminator, definitely. I mean, the whole idea of the alien bounty hunter, He and casting Brian Thompson, there is very much a Terminator feel about this character.
He's wearing a leather jacket when he appears, when he first appears. Like, and is it, where is he? Which is like, you know, where's Sarah Connor?
Where is he? Yeah. I'm surprised he just didn't get him to say, I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle.
I did like that Brian Thompson got to keep his clothes this time, though. Because it was, he's the one in the original Terminator that Schwarzenegger basically mugs, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. I think
he's the only one about the size. Because he didn't go around wearing Bill Paxton's jacket, to be honest.
That's true. He was in Terminator. That's a really strange connection there. And it is definitely a key thing. Apparently, Thompson was, he wasn't anyone, you know, specially brought in for the part, but he came in just as a normal casting call, and he just really impressed people. He had a very distinctive face, which, you know, struck them, very distinctive kind of jawline, and he has a very
presence.
Distinctive look. Yeah, he has a presence about him, and right from the off, as soon as you get, you know, in that great moment where the doctor sees him on the news when they turn him over, and he's looking the least cold man in the world in his little Gino.
I do love the idea that, like, that this is sort of like, this is the most demeaning part of being an alien bounty hunter. Is the bit where after they fish you out of the water, you have to pretend that you were cold.
I can't shiver. I'm an alien. I'm just like...
How awkward must the small talk have been on that boat on its journey back?
It's maybe he's really chatty when we don't see him. You know, he might be. We just see him when he's on the job. Maybe when he's just chilling, he's really chatty and he's like, yeah, you know, I'm not from around here. Don't worry about it.
So should I take in a show? I'm going to be in Syracuse. Can you make... Can you make some recommendations? I'm not normally in this neck of the woods.
But yeah, this whole scene has loads of just those iconic moments. Like, you know, like we say, him stalking the guy. And then, you know, the green toxic blood, which we see not for the first time. We see after the Erlenmeyer flask is where we first saw it. But that comes back. And of course, the alien stiletto, the weapon. The weapon. But it's always that kind of... And then Mark Snow does a on the soundtrack. It's like, just to underscore it.
Just so you know. Yeah. I know that people on this show normally carry guns, but this is serious business.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Do you think, like, I remember reading that it was Duchovny who suggested the alien bounty hunter character.
It might have been. I'm not 100% sure about that. He was obviously involved in the story, and they knew that he was going to be a recurring character. I know that much. They knew that when they cast Brian Thompson, he had that certain presence, and they knew they wanted to bring him back at some point. So it could have been.
But I just sort of, I love how the characters are like this amalgamation of like 1970s science fiction or 1970s, 1980s science fiction tropes. Like, so for example, the alien bounty hunter is like, if you were to pick three words to describe Boba Fett, they would be alien bounty hunter. And true. Despite the fact that, like, there's no indication that, like, bounty hunter, like, that the colonists pay him. Like, for all intents and purposes, he seems more like a government assassin than a bounty hunter. But he's just called that because the name's cool. And obviously he looks like the Terminator. And he can change sort of shape or whatever. And even like the green blood or whatever that comes from the clones and stuff sort of, and the way that it's toxic reminds me of Alien almost.
Yes.
And even like you could argue that the stiletto in the back of the neck is sort of like that, fear of penetration or whatever from Alien. And sort of like, I do love that, like, Colony and Endgame are basically like the 70s B movie of an X-File, in a way that's sort of really great, to really sort of fun, in spite of all like the Frankenstein references and the sort of the purple prose.
Yeah, definitely. There's something else that's interesting with Brian Thompson as well, in that when he got the part, the producers told his agent that he needed to have a buzz cut. Originally, the Alien Bounty Hunter was supposed to have a buzz cut haircut to make him look like a military kind of pilot who'd been shot down. And then, but when he got to Vancouver to film it, there had been some element of misunderstanding, and he hadn't been told that he was going to have a buzz cut. And he was like, I don't want that. I don't want to lose my hair. Said he wouldn't have it. So they were like, right, well, we'll trim it a little bit. I think he had longer hair than he does in this episode, but we'll trim it a little bit. But he ended up, the compromise they reached was that he ended up having the very slick backed hair look, like, you know, fully sort of gelled or watered back. And Spotnitz talks about how they think that was a better look in the end, that it worked better than having him as this very severe sort of buzz crew cut. Which is, it's another little, circumstance of fate that actually helped the show a bit.
That's a coincidence, because it does, it sort of makes him look more like a buzz cut would make him look very military. I think the slick back hair makes him look sort of more Man in Blackish, or more sort of like, I don't want to say alien, because that's the obvious one, but sort of like...
Mercenary.
Like agent.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Absolutely, it's true. It's very true. But it's a really, strong, opening. The noise came from Paul Rabun, who was one of the producers. He just said it into a microphone, and that's where that comes from. It's not an actual noise. It's just a guy in a microphone, like I'm doing, going.
All sound effects provided by Tony Black.
There you go. Not just impressions, but sound effects. You get it all on the X-Cast. But it's a really cool opening scene, really. And then, of course, we get into Mulder and Scully in the office. Scully makes a comment about people firing shots at the White House.
Based on a true story.
Well, I was wondering about this, and I wondered if you knew. Happened. Yeah, because obviously this was the Clinton administration, wasn't it, when this was on. So what's the story behind that?
There were a couple of incidents, basically, in the 90s, around about what this would have been, 94, 95-ish. Yeah. There were just where people had sort of driven by and taken shots at the White House. But it's sort of like, it does play into this sense of, and something that happens a lot in this stretch of the second season, and I think it sort of maybe goes away a little bit in the third, but there's this sense of, like, society collapsing and decaying and eroding. And, like, so for example, here there's the idea of, like, Mulder talking about even the president has to worry about, like, drive-by shootings. And you have stuff like the burning down of the abortion clinic, and you know, the cop is like, even these days giving legal abortions is dangerous. So you have this sense of, like, society sort of breaking down, or even Mulder going to the literal ends of the earth and stuff. Whereas, and then, like, I mean, obviously in Anasazi, like, I think Anasazi even plays off it again. You can tell that, like, Carter read that story about somebody shooting at the White House and was like, okay, well, I'm really going to run with this. Because I think Anasazi has a scene where Scully's in Mulder's apartment and there's a drive-by basically through the window to the point where you can hear the car screeching away after the shots are fired. And it does sort of, it has this nice sort of almost apocalyptic sort of mood to it, I think. And, like, I mean, even stuff like, say, Fearful Symmetry, for example, which is another episode directly after this, has that same sort of, oh, what if the world is ending? And I think even in, is it a Colony or Endgame, they talk about, like, the aliens being concerned that mankind's stewardship of the planet is coming to an end, which is a lot more gentle and a lot more sort of passive than later seasons suggest that the process of transition will be. Like, it seems more like when you're talking about, like, Colony, Endgame, and Fearful Symmetry, the aliens are kind of like, well, look, if you're not going to do anything with the planet, well, you know, we'll step in. I mean, it's a perfectly good planet. Why let it go to waste? And then sort of around the third season, it's like, actually, it's a pretty good planet.
Yeah, we'll take it. It's true. There is that passive element to it. There is a slight difference in how it's put across. That is a good point, really. And I thought the way that Carter enters the story after Mulder sees lots of he finds the connection between the Doctors with his amazingly retro online newspaper clippings.
It isn't that they, like, wrote the text out and emailed it to him because it was important. It's like, no, they cut it. They scanned it. They sent it as an attachment, which, by the way, do you remember how slow the internet was in 1995?
God. Yeah.
Like, that would have been a solid afternoon of work for somebody.
Easily. That's just to have a fancy graphic.
I know that they're, like, 20 Samantha clones, but still, like, you really don't want to be the one who's like, okay, you're the one who's going to be doing this on dial-up. Yeah.
Good luck with that. But yeah. It's getting the connection. I thought it's interesting how he comes into the story with it being abortion doctors, and you know, getting to slightly with this character of Reverend Calvin Sistrunk, who's a bit of a red herring, really, because he's the initial suspect as to why, you know, this doctor has, you know, has been killed, and these identical deaths, suggesting that this, you know, godly man is trying to kill these abortion doctors for the, you know, the right to life idea and things like that. It's interesting because it doesn't, the abortion stuff doesn't really go anywhere, but thematically it ties in with the whole idea of, you know, life and cloning life and death and God and all the moral things behind it. And so it's interesting how he comes in through that perspective, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, like, you could argue that it's even like you talked about earlier how, like, later on in the show, Carter connects. And I think even like at this point, like in Fearful Symmetry, he also, like, he suggests aliens are building an ark. So he does sort of suggest this connection between the alien and the divine. And I think that, like, this weird suggestion that, like, God would want to burn down an abortion clinic, and it turns out actually it was an alien that did it, is maybe a way of overcoming it. I do think also even just stuff like abortion stuff is, like, I think they explain that the reason why the Gregors were working at the abortion clinic was because they wanted access to discarded human tissue, which I think sort of ties into what we were saying a moment ago about, like, aliens sort of being like, oh, okay, well, look, if you guys are going to make yourselves extinct in the next couple of hundred years, well, we'll take the planet too. So it's kind of like this idea of aliens sort of picking up the waste and sort of like being like, okay, well, you know, mankind have really made a hames of this. Let's sort this mess out. Which actually, when I say it like that, sort of makes me wonder the more recent X-Files sort of miniseries, which has a similar sort of idea as well, which is this idea that, like, aliens are not necessarily trying to kill us or destroy us. They're just sort of sitting there and watching us do it to ourselves. And I do wonder, it's kind of an interesting sort of full circle almost that the mythology goes, while taking a very, very interesting counter circle for the middle and most of it.
It's very true. But obviously, this is his method of getting into the story and, you know, getting onto the hunt of all these, you know, these identical doctors. We, of course, get the slightly comical newspaper advertisement. Do you know this man?
there's a really great, like, the headshots of, like, because they had the actor who was playing the identical twins. And it's like, okay, we have two shots of him being a doctor. What we do with the third shot? Does he have, like, a portfolio? Does he look intense? Let's take the intense photo from the actor's portfolio. Because it's like turtleneck and glasses. Like, you could tell he's Gregor with the attitude.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's the bad Gregor, you know, because he's in black. He's dressed in black. But yeah, it's slightly unintentionally funny, really. We have another classic X-Files recurring actor moment here, because the actor who plays the sergeant interrogating them with Sistrunk is an actor called James Laird, who appeared in a very, very similar role, actually, in the Erlenmeyer flask. And I'm certain that he has one of the same lines of dialogue. And he says, well, that information hasn't been released. And I'm sure he says that in both, and this is how X-Files nerd I am, but every time I watch Colony, I think, he said that line in the Erlenmeyer flask. Every single time. Now, I might be wrong, but I'm sure.
I like the idea that that was the audition for the role. It was like, okay, we need somebody who says the line, I'm not sure that information's been released to press, but we need to deliver a convincing. Well, we have this one guy.
Yeah. Oh, well, this is the job for James Laird. There is a couple of examples of people who return in this episode, and we will get to that, who've played parts before. What I liked is that as they're starting to put the pieces together as to where the Gregors are, and Mulder's looking at the map and they're getting the voicemail message and things like that, Scully makes an important point, because she says, are you sure that we're not being set up? You know, she talks about how this whole case doesn't really make much sense, you know, multiple victims and things like that. And I like that, because she's wary now. She's wary of Mulder being... And one of the big themes character-wise in this episode is Mulder losing his perspective and getting too drawn in again to something where he's being led down the rabbit hole intentionally. Scully, now, given based on her experience recently, he's turning around and saying, just stop a minute and think. You have been lied to, you've been set up, you've been, you know, conned before. are you sure this isn't happening again? And it is happening to him. It does happen to him with Ambrose Chapel later.
What's the line? I changed it to trust everyone, didn't I tell you?
That's such a great line.
I mean, I love that. That's one of the things about like Mulder and Scully, because I mean, they are archetypes where like Mulder is the believer and Scully is the skeptic. But there's also this wonderful level of like nuance to them, where obviously like Mulder is, despite the fact he believes in aliens, doesn't believe in God, and Scully, despite the fact she doesn't believe in aliens, believes in God. Whereas on the other hand, you have like Mulder, despite the fact that he's all like trust no one and like the truth is out there and sort of like paranoid and all this concerned about the government and concerned about conspiracies and looking like actively looking for sort of signs that the government has betrayed the people. Mulder is incredibly trusting. He will leap at the first sign. He doesn't have any critical faculty. And like he wants to believe is Mulder's defining attribute more than he trusts no one. Whereas like Scully, who on the other hand is like, most people would consider Scully to be less paranoid than Mulder because she doesn't initially believe in aliens and because she doesn't initially believe in a conspiracy. But she's more skeptical and she's more wary. And like she's the one who actually applies the sort of the critical logic of, well, look, although this theory about secret Soviet twin clones is more likely to be true than identical colonizing aliens from outer space, maybe we should pump the brakes on this, Mulder.
Mm.
And Mulder's like, No. I found another guy and he believes me. Chapel said it's true.
Chapel wouldn't lie to me. my buddy Ambrose. It's it is an important point, and it's something that I think he does obviously get sucked down the rabbit hole many times still.
Krycek took him for advantage. Like Krycek took him for a ride. And like this is basically Krycek like but with less prep work.
Yeah.
This is like an older, less engaged Krycek. Like Krycek at least got coffee. Chapel's just like I'm gonna tag along until you get me what I need.
And I'm gonna look very menacing about it. At least Krycek did try, you know, and ingratiate himself before he stabbed him in the back. But it is that whole thing of Mulder, I think, does become a little bit more aware as time goes on throughout the show of the possibilities being conned. It doesn't always happen. He does often get, you know, sucked down the rabbit hole, as I say, but he does get a bit more, he's got a bit more nouse about it as time goes on. Here, he's very keen to be led. And Scully now has seen enough and she's gone through enough of a character arc of having to get over the abduction and get over the fear of, you know, of certain aspects of her work, to be at the point where she's turning around and saying, look, we've got to be careful, okay? What we're doing, the things we're looking into, is dangerous. And this is the theme that comes up throughout this episode.
I think, actually, to be honest, I would argue that I think that later on in the episode, when they have that conversation that we're talking about, I get the sense that the writers, like, when you're talking about Colony and Endgame, and we're talking about how, like, the mythology is still being formed, and the writers haven't entirely figured out what they're doing yet or where they're going exactly, I think that like they're still at the stage where they're sort of struggling with what to do with Scully's abduction. Because I think that like there's a moment in, well, okay, there are several moments in the episode that I found a little sort of tone deaf almost after Scully's abduction arc. And one of them is the bit where like Mulder's like, where, you know, Scully's like, a man died because we sent him out to do this thing. And Mulder's like, well, that's just part of the job. And you're like, dude, maybe not to Scully. Maybe don't say that to Scully. I think Scully understands firsthand that there are costs to working in the FBI with you. You don't need to get all righteous, Mulder. You know, it's or even the bit where later, I do wonder if obviously Dwayne Barry and Ascension were sort of like improvised around Gillian Anderson's pregnancy and stuff. But I do wonder if we're still at the stage where the writers haven't necessarily figured out what they're doing with that, if that makes sense. I think they figure out, and they, like, between the second and third seasons, they nail it down and they figure it out. But I think now, I'm not sure they're quite cognizant of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. They are still finding, still a lot of the mythology and a lot of the ideas, they're still at this point finding their feet and figuring it out as they go along. But I think the scene that Mulder and Scully have later on, and given we're on the subject, we might as well talk about this now, really, is, you know, it's a consequence of the stuff that happens in the interim, you know, with Chapel and with Special Agent Weiss, who we'll get to in a minute. But you've got all this idea that Scully and Mulder's lines of how far they will go for this are in very different places. Scully's the one who turns around and she says, you know, we a man's died, we have to know where to draw the line in looking into this stuff. And he's really cold. You know, he's really cold about it. And he's like, tough shit.
We all draw our own lines. Yeah,
tough shit. You know, he died. He knew what he was getting into. Yeah. We all draw our own lines. And Mulder's is so far to the point of, you know, as she says, to the point of insanity.
Well, literally being the end of the earth.
Yeah, he will go...
The end of the earth, like literally.
Yeah, he will go right down there. He will put everything on the line. He will risk his entire life and everything in the pursuit of truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of the things, like, we talk about Carter's sort of writing and Carter's sort of, like, heightened tone. Like, that scene is something that's sort of, like, brilliant, because it's the most literal statement of who these characters are in this most, like, very straightforward, like, statement of purpose for both of them. Like, it's a scene that exists primarily so that, like, and it's called back to in Endgame, where basically Mulder says, look, I'm drawing the line for you. I'm drawing your line. I'm going, and I realize that I can't expect you to go with me. And then Scully basically goes with him anyway. But it's, like, this wonderfully sort of, like, heightened, over-the-top sort of, like, and when I say romantic, this is what I mean when I say romantic. Like, this 18th century idea of, like, people governed by, like, passion and by emotion and by a need to know that's not necessarily rational. And we'll talk about it more when we get to Endgame, because that's one of the big... It's one of the themes of the two-parter, but it's something that really comes out, I think, in the final act of Endgame, where characters actually talk about, like, is you chasing this idea to the edge of reason, to the end of the earth, to the end of your life? Is it worth doing that, even if you cannot come back from it physically? Which is, like, rationally, the answer is always going to be no. It's never worth doing anything if you can't come back from it, because the experience will ultimately amount to nothing. But romantically, it's like, yes, because the experience itself has intrinsic worth, and the knowledge means something beyond my ability to carry it with me. And I think that, like, that's like a beautiful, really sort of powerful Carter sentiment. And I think that, like, when you talk about Colony and Endgame working, I think that's one of the ways that it really does work. And, like, the red line scene in Colony is just one of those moments.
It's a great moment. And it's one of the real, really strong first instances of Mulder and Scully, ideologically and in terms of how far they will go, having that real conflict. And it's a great scene. It's really well put together. It's really well written and performed. And it pays...
And performed.
Yeah, performed as well. It pays off a lot of what happens in the interim, you know. And as we said, just going back, Special Agent Weiss...
Yeah.
That poor guy. I felt so sorry for this guy. Talk about the wrong place, wrong phone he picked up.
We talked about how, like, Colony and Endgame are, like, the boiled down essence of, like, an X-Files mythology two-parter. And, like, Vice is, like, the template for the poor guy who happens to wander onto the wrong case with Mulder and Scully and pays the horrible price. Like, there are plenty of examples. I don't want to mention any by name because that will obviously spoil them. But, for example, there's one in, say, Tempest Fugit, yeah. That I think we're both, or there's actually several in
the
Tempest
first
Fugit.
One I thought of, funnily enough, when you said that, he was the first person that came into my head. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and there is, because there's a sense of, like, that's the quintessential, like, it's something the X-Files comes back to again and again and again, which is, like, the quest for truth comes at a high price. And that price, obviously, Scully pays it when she's abducted, and Mulder pays it in various ways over the course of the show. But, like, all these special agents and all these people or victims who are on the crossfire also end up paying it in a way that's like, I think that Vice is notable perhaps because I don't think is he the first, but he's certainly the first one that I remember when I think of the mythology.
He stands out as the first, like, mythology red shirt, effectively, in that he gets, you know, he gets embroiled. He's very, very quickly, he gets embroiled. He goes to the house, he's looking for the doctor. He sees, you know, the bounty hunter kill him, and then he's dead, you know.
In the most awkwardly framed shot ever. We talked about, like, the difference between how Colony's directed and how Endgame's directed. Like, the scene where Vice is sticking his head in the window, and he can see the Gregor, but he can't see the alien bounty hunter, for example. Like, that's stock television editing.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there just happens to be this blocking wall. They're having this conversation in a really forced manner. So that I can't see one of the participants.
It's true. And it doesn't, yeah, the direction isn't perfect for this, but it gets the point across, really, of what...
No, it does.
Of what Weiss, if it essentially does, you know. And there's an interesting question in terms of the alien makeup here, in that when the Doctor's killed and his body is decaying, you know, in the green blood on the floor, and then he shoots the bounty hunter, and then obviously the toxic blood is, my eyes. I've wondered why doesn't he get that reaction when he looks at the dead body? Is it because the body's dead and the oxidization is different compared to the live blood? Because the suggestion is that the bounty hunter and the clones have the same biochemistry. You know, they both have the same blood, they have the same genetic makeup. So is it that the body is dead and then the effect doesn't happen. I don't know. It's strange.
It happens again later on as well when Scully's with Agent Chapel after he kills the Gregor in question there, and there's a green puddle and Scully steps in it. And Scully steps in it and her shoe doesn't immediately dissolve. It takes a little while to dissolve. She comes in the following morning with it. But you also don't see it begin to emit the toxic gas until conveniently after Scully has left the area. Which is weird. So I don't know whether there's a reason beyond sort of plot convenience to it. Because it would be really, really crap if Scully died in an alleyway because she happened to step in what was left of the Gregor.
Some green goo, yeah.
Talk about people paying the ultimate cost for Mulder's quest.
It's true. The one thing that came from the... Because one of the scenes I remember the most when I was a kid was the moment where the who we think is Weiss opens the trunk. And then Weiss is dead in there, curled up in his pants. And then he closes the trunk and you see him, you know, shapeshift. And that was one of the... For a start, it's a complete what the fuck? Because that's out of nowhere. You don't know he can shapeshift at this point. And you're like, what? Oh my God. Like, this guy, he's truly alien, as I said before. But it's also a really chilling scene.
It is, and it works really well. Like, for all that, like, The X-Files wasn't a huge budget show at this point, that's a great special effect because he turns his head one way, and then he turns it the other way, and all of a sudden it's Brian Thompson. But it's not a cut.
No.
It's not like an awkward morph. It's not like the characters, because you can tell when they do special effects where if they have the actor stand still, they're just doing like a fade effect. That's like we're doing a scene and we're showing off how complicated it is just by having the character move while this is happening.
Given from an age where some effects do look clunky, it does work. It actually still does work, and it's really quite scary and really quite chilling. I did think though, especially when I was watching it this time, would nobody have seen this? Like, that's an open street in the middle of the day. Surely somebody's walking their dog, somebody's, you know, on their lawn, you know, brushing the leaves away, somebody's looking out the window. Would nobody have seen a big guy just suddenly transform into somebody else?
I mean, there's, like, we talk about, like, the alien bounty hunter and how he must be really chill when he's off duty. He also, like, there are points where he seems massively incompetent. Like, there's the moment when he gets fished out of the water and, like, the Gregor immediately recognizes him from the news footage. Even though, like, he's half the world away. And you're like, okay, could you not just, like, wear the face of some random stranger?
Exactly. Why is he... why is he himself?
Yeah.
It's true.
And there's a moment later on where he's stalking Scully, and she looks out the window, and it's Brian Thompson sitting in the car. And you're like, could you not just, like, I don't know, pretend to be walking a dog or something? I also do wonder, one of my recurring questions about the bounty hunter, it's probably one of those, like, along with the blood, something best not asked, is clothes and stuff. How does that work? So is it like does he arrive, like, does he have to buy them? Can he change with his body? Because obviously he has to strip Vice to get the clothes and stuff. But I just sort of wonder, like, does that mean then he has to find somebody who's, like, the same body shape that he is? And, like, when the Gregors dissolve, they don't, like, dissolve in suits. Although I suppose if the blood's acidic, it would probably burn it up. But it's still... It looks like when the Gregors die, they just melt.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, because when we get to the climax and he appears as Mulder, he's dressed exactly as Mulder's dressed. You know, he's got the same clothes on, and he hasn't stripped Mulder naked or anything. He hasn't kidnapped him and locked him somewhere.
There's a deleted scene of him in, like, the local Walmart, just sort of trying on clothes as Mulder, going, I don't think this works with me. This doesn't work with us.
You had me going for a minute. I genuinely thought that was real for a minute.
Well, if you said it with an ominous Mark Snow score, it would work.
It's
just
true. It is an interesting... It's little things like this that you, to an extent, you have to turn a blind eye to, because they are big questions about the logistics and the logic of how the alien bounty hunter works and how this works.
It's totally worth glossing past because the episode is really great.
It works in that sense.
I mean, I remember talking to somebody who argued that, like, these questions only occur to you under two circumstances. And the first circumstance is when you've watched something like 30 times, which I think is why it's occurring to us here. And the other circumstance is when the story being told is so boring that your mind's going, okay, well, what can I interest myself in that isn't the story? And I think that this is very much the former case, where it's like, okay, we've watched this like 30 or 40 times. We can now sort of, like, maybe sort of play with them, if not sort of pull them apart.
Absolutely. That's absolutely the case, yeah. And I think what I like about the whole thing with Weiss is that it has a consequence. And it's not always something that happens in TV shows and not always in The X-Files, but Weiss's death matters because Mulder then is hauled into Skinner's office and they have this really interesting conversation in which Skinner just bollocks him and says, look, my man's dead. And Mulder says, interestingly, he says, I thought we had a bit of an understanding. And he's a bit too casual with Skinner, because after Skinner, yeah. you know, saved the X-Files, brought them back as a middle finger to the Smoking Man, effectively, which is what he was doing, then Mulder's kind of read into it and thinking, ah, oh, Skinner's my mate, you know, he's my fam, I'm all right with him.
He's cool dad
yeah,
now.
Yeah, he's cool dad, right?
Yeah, he's...
But Skinner's like, no, son.
He's not cool dad.
No, man, you don't take the piss, right? I've helped you, but a man is dead. And, you know, he says that, and he says, a man is dead. You know, it's great, because it's great when Mitch Pileggi gets to really sort of get annoyed, because he does it so well.
And there are lines that would not work as well if Pileggi was not as good as he is. Like, there's a moment where he's like, and your ass and mine will be in a sling.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's a patently ridiculous line to use in that context. But, like, Pileggi's just like, I'm going full tilt yeah. into it. And it's like, okay, I'm like, you feel like if you were Mulder, you would be flinching in the seat.
Yeah, totally. You would be scared of him. It's just, I just like the fact that it has a payoff. And it has to get Mulder, you know, it ties into the whole things that we talked about with the Mulder and Scully scene later and Mulder's, you know, line being drawn. But it also ties into the underlying little, you know, underscore of what's going on with the X-Files department and the relationship with Skinner and Mulder and this, you know, this very sort of, you know, nebulous position that Skinner is in, whether or not he is it more in with the bad guys or he is with Mulder, you know, and it's something that's never truly 100% answered in many ways on the X-Files. There is always that little bit of Skinner that has one foot in that camp. A little bit. Certainly yeah. certainly in the early seasons more than the later ones.
I think even in the later seasons, they still do kind of go back to that for better or for worse.
Yeah, a little bit. And it's good. It's good because it does give him a shade of ambiguity, which is even when he's effectively one of yeah. them, you know, he's a good guy in many respects. It does give him that. But in this, it's a really good scene. And, it, you know, it has that effect of snapping Mulder back a bit and making him go, well, you can't just piss off and do what you want and investigate what you want and, you know, a man dies who you've brought into this.
Leave a trail of dead bodies.
Yeah, you yeah. can't do that, right? There are consequences to your investigations, however dangerous they are. So it was really good to see that. Then we get Ambrose Chappell, a character named, incidentally, after a character in the 1956 Hitchcock movie, The Man Who Knew Too Much. That version of it, because in that film, James Stewart is searching for his kidnapped son, and he incorrectly assumes that a name found in a note is the name of a man who can help him, and the name is Ambrose Chappell. So it's more of a reference actually than a character in the film, but it's actually the name of a church in London where they're holding his son. So it is in that film, it's effectively like a misdirection. And you could definitely say the same about Chappell in this episode.
I mean, you could argue even like the James Stewart looking for his son, you've got Mulder looking for his sister.
Well, yeah.
You've got the same sort of even dynamic at play almost.
And that would have been an obvious nod. You know, you don't just make up a name like Ambrose Chappell. That's that would have been a definite nod from Carter.
Yeah, I mean, well, Ambrose Chappell is a very sort of Chris Carter name. Like we've talked about the tendency before of Carter to give his characters names that sort of stand out, like Dwayne Barry or whatever. Or sort of Noel Rohr. Ambrose Chappell, I could plausibly believe as a Carter name of its own right, but I think, yeah, I think it's definitely a shout.
Nothing will ever beat Noel Rohr. I mean, that's the greatest name I've ever heard a character be called.
And the way it's spelt as well. Like, but sorry.
Noel Rohr.
It's just going to be the Noel Rohr appreciation show. appreciation show.
I'm going to love it. When I'm like 75 yeah. and I'm finally getting to season 8 of this show, yeah, it's going to be great. But this whole scene with Chappell's really good as well. As we've talked about, it lays out the alternate, you know, explanation as to what is going on, the fake explanation, the red herring. Tom Butler is a really good actor in this. He plays Chappell really well. He was in Ghost in the Machine. He was the guy who gets killed at the very start of Ghost in the Machine previously. So he's another one of the recurring actors.
The X-Files variety players.
Yeah, 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 basically. I think he just gives Chappell a real air of, you know, believability, even though he is, at this point, not Ambrose Chappell. We never actually find out what happened with Chappell either. We never find out if he's dead. We don't find out if he's just been impersonated. You know, we never meet the real Chappell. This is the bounty hunter undercover. But even so, he manages to give the character later on when we realise he's the bounty hunter, when, you know, Dr. Dickens sees him and then the chase and everything, he does it really menacingly and he kind of, you know, does a little a version of Brian Thompson. But before that, he is a character. He is a spook. And I think he put, plays that very well. And the story he puts across, he's well constructed, I think.
Funny you should mention like the story that he puts across. So he basically suggests that the aliens are actually like they're Russian clones who are being sort of put in place to sort of undermine U.S. security and stuff like that. It's kind of like interesting because it's that sense, and it's again, you go back to the first season, but the sense of like the idea of aliens replacing the Soviet Union as a plausible threat for the United States is something that like it comes up in Fallen Angel, where I think that the character who's in charge of the retrieval is described as like a Cold War retrieval expert and stuff like that. And you have this sort of sense of passage almost where like in the second season, end of the second season, the Cold War has been over at this stage for, you know, 4 years or whatever. And the X-Files were then transitions into telling a story that's not so much about the transition out of the Cold War as it is about like the aftermath of the Cold War. And I think you see that with like Tunguska and Terma. So I think that like Colony and Endgame using like the Cold War as a backdrop almost for a transition point. So I think it isn't even like Brian Thompson, you know, isn't the alien bounty hunter's story that he's a Russian pilot and stuff like that, I believe, isn't it?
He's a Russian spy killer is what Chapel suggests he is. Which is a really cool. It's a really cool thing. I wish we need more Russian spy killers. That's a really cool thing.
He's a Russian who kills spies, not a spy who kills Russians. But no, he's also a Russian fighter pilot as well. Earlier in the story, well, when they pull him from the water, so there's that sort of sense of like the literal Cold War or Cold Warrior because he's being pulled from the ice, sort of thawing and becoming this sort of amorphous alien thing, which is quite clever as well. And like I also like that, was it the quote that Chapel says where he's like the Gregor plan is basically to destroy the country's immune system, which is sort of this thing that Carter returns to again and again and again, which is this viral metaphor. Like, and I think that later on obviously it becomes more literal in terms of when he defines what the colonists actually are, but throughout the show there's this metaphor of like virus as something infectious and contagious. So for example, when like they're talking about the effects of, you know, the effects of that green poison goop that you're talking about that causes, was it the blood clots so it curdles like jelly. So it basically turns the immune system on itself. It has that nice sort of like 90s AIDS paranoia almost. Yeah. This idea of like immune systems sort of turning against themselves. And I think that also sort of plays into the theme of like colonization. When Carter talks about like the idea that aliens are going to colonize us or that we'll be replaced, that you know, that basically the country and the government that we think is supposed to protect us is going to in fact be used as an instrument to destroy us or to undermine us or to attack us. And I think that's a very, like, again, we talk about Carter's recurring themes and stuff like that. He does F-Emasculate later in the season as well, which is a more literal virus story. He does that one with Howard Gordon, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I love that episode. That's a great episode. And yeah, it touches on similar things in some respects, and it you're absolutely right there. There's some great observations. I think it is the aliens being a facsimile of this, you know, this Soviet invader almost is a really true parallel, and it comes out in this story, and it leads to the most end game part of the episode, really, which is the big chase when they, you know, they go looking for Dr. Dickens, and then he jumps out the window when he sees Chapel. A really extreme reaction. Out the window he goes. Yeah.
I like the idea that before it happened, like before we sort of joined them, Samantha's like, look, whatever happens, play it cool. And Dickens is like, okay, I can do cool. It's like he opens the door, like Mulder and Scully. He's like, "Oh, oh!"
He just legs it out the window. Interesting, you mention Samantha, and I say that in quote marks, which we'll get into in Endgame. But I think that's really well done because you don't know who she is. In retrospect, when you look at her, she is totally a grown up Samantha Mulder. But you, at that point when you're first watching it, you've no idea who she is. She's just a random woman. She could be his daughter. So for her to be there, and it's suggested there's a mystery about her with how Scully almost notices her before she runs out, and then she's hiding. So there is that. Who is this woman? What's going on there? But it's really sort of subtly layered in, and then later on you get this.
Then the bombshell.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It is a literal bombshell of a twist in this episode, because that's the thing. You've got to the point now where Chapel has killed another one of the clones. You've had this big chase. Mulder should be in hospital after getting hit by that car. I'm sorry. That was... he shattered the windscreen.
But his... That's a very load-bearing phone.
Oh, God. Yeah, it must... Yeah, that's the only explanation for it. It's just ridiculous.
The breaking of the phone would seem to be to set up sort of the disconnect between Mulder and Scully, wouldn't it? Like him losing the mobile.
Yeah.
Because there's a bit later on where they seem to keep missing each other, which wouldn't be possible if Mulder had his
exactly,
mobile.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is a nice sort of technical writing, bit of
that,
technical
that
writing.
That is true. That's setting that up, definitely. But, you know, you've got this point. You've got to the point where, you know, these guys are still dying. Like you said, they've found out that Weiss's blood curdled like jelly, so there is... There is that element, but then you do get this bombshell of a twist, because you don't see this coming at all. When he thinks he's going up to Skinner to get a bollock in again, and then he says, "Oh yeah, you've got to go home. Your parents have called. Your dad's called." What? Where's this come from? Like, because it's a in like the last like, almost the third act of the episode, you don't expect this to just veer off and for Mulder to completely take himself out of the what you think is the story. I mean, though obviously it does tether back to the entire story and it is what the story's about, it's a bit of a brave choice to do this, isn't it? At this point in an episode, when you seem to have a handle on the plot, and then suddenly, what?
Not even this point in the episode, this point in the series. Like, Mulder's family, like, primarily we know his missing sister. We haven't encountered his father directly before to this point. Like, this is the first appearance of William Mulder. Like, he's been alluded to, I think, in Roland in the first season, in, like, that dream that Mulder talks about where he's underwater and he can't reach him, which, again, is a nice bit of thematic setup, if not literal setup, which tells you everything you need to know about the relationship. And I think also in Aubrey, he talks about, like, his father seeds late at night or whatever, and how that sort of is contagious or infectious. But, yeah, to basically to go, okay, well, we're you know, two-thirds of the way through this gigantic mythology episode with a shape-shifting alien, a bunch of clones are identical to each other. Mulder, you should go talk to your dad. It's like it's a really crazy left field twist at the time, and it ties back in incredibly cleverly. Like, I mean, you say that like Samantha's set up very, very well, or Samantha in inverted commas is set up very well, but it's a twist that if you didn't do it right, it would seem ridiculous. But the episode does it just well enough that I think it works. And again, like this idea of Mulder's family has been like it's unspoken, unseen, but it's been talked about in the background so much. It's strange like to get it thrust into the foreground, not at the start of an episode, not even halfway through an episode, but two-thirds of the way episode. It's like, okay, on top of everything, here's the cherry, except the cherry is another ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah. Here you go. Your sister's back. The character your entire you know mindset has been about. And oh, here she is. And it's like, what? And David Duchovny's, you know, reaction is really good, because he certainly Mulder's just dumbstruck. You know, he's just like, what? This can't be. What? No, really? It's great because it's what I really liked as well was how they introduced Bill Mulder, because it really mythologizes him straight away. You know, he's sitting on his porch, he's half in shadow, he's having a smoke. And then, you know, he has this strained handshake with his son. And then he shows that sort of penchant for the Mulder monologue, doesn't he? Because he starts going, oh, for years, things that had been destroyed, I never expected.
It's a comfort, the sort of closure.
Yeah.
Which is another one of those, the certainty, it becomes a comfort that allows you to move on. We bury our memories so deep after all that have been destroyed. Never expecting. And then Mulder sort of cut in going, who's mom talking
what's
to?
What's this all about?
It's like, well, William's like, William's like, I had this big thing prepared. I'll get to that.
I've been waiting like 30 years to do this, man. Just give me a break. Yes. But the thing is, and this is something that I've wondered, did Bill know that this was a setup? Now, because I can only assume that he must have known. He must have known that wasn't Samantha. Because surely by this point, because, you know, we don't know. In this episode, this two-parter doesn't get into the truth about Bill at this point. That's saved for Anasazi and then
subsequently. Or even the truth about Samantha, to be honest.
No, it doesn't, exactly.
Like, I mean, there's a detail at the end of Endgame which does not jar at all with what we eventually discover about Samantha. Mm. And the thing is, Endgame treats it as this huge deal. And it's like... when you get to the seventh season, you're like, wait a minute, dick move.
Yeah, exactly. There's some interesting things done with that. But the thing with this is, we don't know yet who Bill is. We don't know yet his connection to all the big stuff that's going on. But at this stage, it strikes me as somebody who didn't expect this to happen, but he knows deep down that this isn't real. And that he must have known that she was probably dead by this point. He must have known that, you know, or she was out there with the aliens. I think the impression I get is that he didn't tell Mulder the truth for obviously many reasons, but I think partly he couldn't tell Tina either. Tina always knew more, Mulder's mom. She always knew more than she let on, Tina did.
She admitted.
Yeah. And I don't think she knew, don't get me wrong, but I think he did. And I think he didn't want to destroy this because maybe he thought that she was back and they could keep her. And even though it's not really his daughter, maybe he thought, do you know what? If she's back, maybe she's back and this is good enough.
I'm going to be honest. Like, I think, like, no matter how emotionally stunted Bill Mulder is, and I love that scene that you mentioned where, like, Fox comes in for a hug and William's like, no, handshake will do. But there's no matter how emotionally stilted or disconnected William might be, I think that if your daughter or somebody who is so convincing that you could honestly believe that she is your daughter shows up, I think you would welcome her. I think that you'd part of you would want to believe to drop in that sort of that phrase.
Yeah, I think so.
No matter how cynical and jaded you might be. And I mean, more sort of pragmatically, I suspect, and I don't know how true this is, I can't speak for any authority, but part of me suspects that the writers, this idea at this point, had no idea what they were going to do with the Samantha story later on. But I do think that, like, looking at the way that William Mulder is treated in Colony and Endgame, I think it's safe to say that they knew what they were doing as late as, say, the second episode of the third season. So, like, for example, you have the scene of William Mulder introduced smoking a cigarette on the porch, which, if you're smoking a cigarette in the X-Files, like, you're literally going to be in the shadow of one other character. So, by the way, when it turns out, when that development continues later on, that makes sense considering how he was introduced. But there's even, like, we'll probably talk about it when we get to Endgame, but, like, there's scenes between Fox and William in Colony and Endgame that read differently and cleverly and in a way that makes a great deal of sense when you factor in, say, The Blessing Way and Paperclip. And we talked about this at the start. Even if the writers didn't know exactly where they were going with the mythology in terms of, like, dates and facts, and we're going to drop this trinket in the third season, we're going to hold this back for the fourth, I think that they knew that, like, with William Mulder, they are going to do these things and they're going to reveal these things about him, about what he knew and what he didn't know. And while I'm not convinced that he knows this is the wonder of talking about the X-Files mythology. It's like, I don't know that they knew that he knew, but I don't think that they knew that Bill Mulder would know with any certainty that his daughter was dead or gone at this point. I think that they were assuming or they were reading it so that he would know that she was gone. He would know roughly where she had gone, and he would know that he was responsible for that. I get the sense watching Endgame and Colony and Endgame that, like, the writers weren't like, he knows for sure that she's not coming back.
Yeah.
Like, I think that the way that it's written, Bill Mulder, some part of him believes that it's possible that she could come back. And whether or not the fact that he's out on the porch is, like, shame or guilt or, like, even just reluctance to connect back to her, knowing that the people who took her won't let her stay, I don't think that he knows that it's definitely not her. Mm. I don't sort of read that in his performance or in the way the character's sort of written.
It's very ambiguous.
On the X-Files, never. But it's so good. And Peter Donat is so good as well. He was in The Godfather 2, actually. I was watching The Godfather 2, and it's like, what is William Mulder doing on a Senate subcommittee? He's one of the guys who heads that sort of investigation into the Corleone family as well. And he looks like Peter Donat aged phenomenally. So it really does. You can imagine your X-Files headcanon can be William Mulder was in some capacity investigating the Corleone family.
Let's assume that's true, because that's amazing.
I want to believe
in that. Do you know who they wanted originally to play Bill Mulder, though?
I'm going to go with the guy who played Kolchak the Night Stalker, which is Darren McGavin, isn't it?
Absolutely true, yeah. Who later went on to play Arthur Dales, who was basically Mulder's 1950s equivalent, who began the X-Files.
He was the father of the X-Files. Yes, he was the father of the X-Files, if not the father of Fox Mulder.
Exactly. He turned it down when he's offered the role. Although I think he later regretted it. I think he later came, obviously then he came on a few seasons later to play Arthur Dales, but I think he, before he died, but I think he then regretted not playing Bill Mulder, because it would have been a really sort of, you know, for Chris Carter, having based the X-Files heavily on Kolchak, it would have been a really nice tether. then, you know, it works in many respects with Arthur Dales as well. But for him to be Mulder's dad would, I think, would have been really something special.
I think it also works, though, because they did convince him to appear in Millennium, in the second season of Millennium, as well as Frank Black's
yeah,
father.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Which is really cool that, like, Darren McGavin is basically woven into the DNA of all these Chris Carter characters in a way that's sort of metaphorical with Mulder, but literal with Frank Black. I think that's a nice sort of point of intersection. Mm. I probably would have thought it would be a bit much. I wonder if he'd played William Mulder, he probably wouldn't have been allowed to play Frank Black's
That's
father.
True. That is true. And we wouldn't have got him in Midnight of the Century, which is just a gorgeous piece of television. But yeah, you've now set up, you know, you have these pieces in play. The story is taken, for Mulder, it seems seemingly taken a very left turn. Scully is still investigating the case, you know, and she's on the trail of the bounty hunter, effectively, as he's squashing, like, alien embryos and
using
feet.
Her skulking jogging outfit.
Yeah, yeah, the Scully jogging outfit. But she now knows she's in danger. She now knows she's in trouble. So she at first is tracking these doctors, and then she, you know, she gets them safe when she finds the three who are still around in what Frank Spotnitz later admitted was a horrible visual of the three doctors walking down those steps next to each other. And he said, we actually made sure that when we had the Samantha clones in Endgame, we made sure we didn't shoot that in the same way because we hated that shot of the three doctors standing next to each other.
Going down the
steps. Yeah. The tables have turned there. She now knows she's in danger because the bounty hunter's got his eye on her. And she's panicked and worried, trying to contact Mulder, can't get him. Like you said, the phone was broken. All lots of different reasons why she can't get in touch with Mulder. But then, of course, Samantha connects it all up. And there's a great moment where she just hits him with lots of massive stuff. Like when she says, oh yeah, by the way, these clone doctors are my adoptive parents. They're not from this planet. They are definitely aliens. I've been with them. yeah, they're in danger. You need to help me. That's why I'm here. And he's like, what? What?
Like, I kind of, part of me sort of imagines, like, Mulder's immediate response would have been, you are so lucky you are not Scully's missing sister.
Yeah, it's true. Because he has no objectivity at this point. No,
he's just like,
he's like, fine, okay. The episode, and this is what the episode's built up really well, with everything with Weiss and Skinner and all this stuff, it's built up this point where Mulder is past the line. He's got no objectivity. He is sucked in. His sister's back, or he thinks it's his sister. He will do anything at this point to keep going down this path. And I think this episode builds that up really well while escalating the story and escalating the peril and the suspense of also the fact that the bounty hunter could be anyone, anywhere. When Scully's on that bus, there are lots of moments, until you see him sitting there with a paper looking very indiscreet. He's there with a paper on the bus. He's like, yeah, just reading the paper, just chilling. Yeah. There is those shots, isn't there, of different people that Scully's looking at. You know, is it him? Is it him? Is it him?
Who could be?
Yeah, him. You know, and this is really well constructed. I think this final set, this final collection of scenes. You know, Mulder's trying to call her and things like that, and leave messages. You know, when he realizes she's in trouble, or she could be in trouble. I think it's really well put together as we build up to the cliffhanger.
It is, but at the same time, I find myself like the motel manager is one of those incredibly ridiculous contrivances.
Yeah, definitely.
It's vitally important. Her life may depend on it. I need you to tell Scully when she shows up
Scully.
To call Mulder.
Scully, which is not a common name. Scully.
Well, to be fair, the way it's written, Mulder repeats his own name, which is not the most competent way of, like, getting that across. The name that you need to remember is Mulder. Mulder, but then the motel manager still goes, and I like that he doesn't just go, you know, I don't really care. He actually makes an effort to write it down, and then the nub of his pencil breaks. It's like, curses, foiled again.
Who's this message for?
What was that name?
Yeah. Oh, come on, mate.
I work in a motel?
Yeah.
What is this place?
The fact she walks in straight away. It's not like there's even a gap, right, where he could conceivably be busy and forget. She walks in straight away. Surely, at the moment she would have said Scully, he'd have gone, hang on a minute.
Where do I know that name from? Yeah.
It's really bad. It's really bad. That did stick out to me as well. It's ridiculous.
But the rest of it works very well. The thing about the alien bounty hunter being able to change faces and like the fact that Samantha emphasizes he could be anyone and you wouldn't know who he is and your partner wouldn't be able to recognize him really does tap into that 90s paranoia, like the fear that anybody around you could be like an agent or could be betraying you or could be somebody you can't trust. I think that like as goofy as like a character called the alien bounty hunter who can change his face and bleeds green blood is, like, there's something very sort of X-Files about what he represents.
Yeah. And he is just relentless. And, you know, as we said earlier about the Terminator thing, he is terrifying in that he won't stop until he's done, you know, and he's seemingly unstoppable. He's seemingly unkillable. He is truly sort of a force. And, you would think Scully would be in danger. If he was after her, you would think, how is she going to get out of that? And that is exactly what this cliffhanger does. It still gives me chills. When I watched it the other day, the moment when he walks in and then the phone rings and it's Scully, and she turns with this look as if to go, oh, fuck. it is chills.
It's a very effective cliffhanger.
It's brilliant.
I do have to say, though, I feel like I'm being more negative about the episode than I really should be. But I mean, I do think that there's a point where this is the third cliffhanger in the season that's hinged on Scully being placed in danger or taken away from Mulder.
That is true.
I think even Frank Spotnitz makes the point later on in the season when he's talking about our town, where there is a sense that in the second season they go a little bit, they lean a little bit too heavily into the Scully in peril sort of aspect of it. Because this is after, like, obviously, when she's abducted at the end of Dwayne Barry, obviously, when Mulder discovers that she's missing at the end of Ascension, and then again here, Scully's sort of taken away. And there's a sense that, and I feel really bad that because I've done this repeatedly when we're talking about the second season, I'm like, but yes, but in the third season, they do a much better job of balancing this. But I think they do, and I think that this is probably one of my issues with Colony, is perhaps that, like, as effective as the ending is, and I think we'll probably talk about it when we get to Endgame, but there's something very powerful about the image of Scully being like attacked by Mulder on just like a primal sort of level, if only because, like, in a way it sort of represents the way that being close to Mulder has physically hurt her and scarred her and sort of like cost her, like, it's really being close to Mulder and trusting Mulder has cost Scully pretty much everything. But I do think that, like, going to the climax of having Scully in peril again, it's maybe just a little bit too much at this point.
Yeah, from that perspective, it is a good point. It is a good point. It would have been even more interesting if it was flipped. If it was, you know, I mean, it is Scully for the reason of that it's something so unbelievable for her that it makes it a little bit more interesting. Whereas Mulder would probably just go, oh, cool, you're an alien.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like,
can we talk?
Yeah, he'd be really excited. Can we say aliens? He'd be like, oh, my God. Whereas Scully's like, shit. Who is what?
There's also just the legitimate sort of like plotting reason of like Colony and Endgame are about Mulder reuniting with Samantha. So he has his own plot thread.
Well, yeah.
So you need something for Scully to do while this is happening. And logically, the thing to do, you can't really, because of the way the episode's paced, you can't have the big reveal be, oh, my God, Mulder, your sister's back, because you still have another act of information to convey. So by default, Scully gets the cliffhanger. And the way to do a cliffhanger is to put Scully in danger. And, like, I'm aware of that, and I don't want to be too picky. Like, logistically, there are reasons for it. It just, it is a bit jarring, yeah. I think.
No, I completely get that. I do get that. But it does end the episode on a whopping big moment, which has been well constructed. So, yeah, we're gonna put a pin in this now, and we're gonna come back soon. But, yeah, that was Colony.
I'm in danger, Fox.
What do you mean?
You've been contacted. You know there's a man hunting my father and the other doctors.
Your father?
My adoptive parents. They're only visitors here. What people would call aliens. A bounty hunter's been sent to kill them. You've met this man. His lies to you have caused others like my father to die. He won't stop until he's killed them all, and anyone who tries to stop him. He'll come for me soon.
As I say, we're gonna hold off the goodbyes because Darren will be back for Endgame, which follows this episode up. So we're gonna end the episode on a cliffhanger, and we're gonna end the podcast on a cliffhanger. So I think one of us needs to say to be continued.
Tony, it's me. Tony, it's me. Tony, are you there? Tony?
The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A-Y-E.